What makes your mom special? Call 217-244-1989 and leave us a voicemail about why your mom is like no other. Don't forget to leave your name, your city, and your mom's name. Again, call 217-244-1989 and listen for a special Mother's Day edition of the Dialogue Podcast on Illinois Soul.
From Illinois Soul, this is Dialogue. I'm Reginald Hardwick. Dialogue is an exchange about culture straight from the soul. There's a crowded field of candidates running for the Champaign Unit 4 School Board. In recent years, board members have clashed with one another and administrators, and many candidates are running to heal the divided board. IPM education reporter Emily Hayes put together a guide on ipmnewsroom.org so voters can learn more about the candidates and their views ahead of the election on April 1st. She talked with IPM's Kimberly Schofield about the candidates.
Emily, there are 11 candidates running for 5 seats. What can you tell us about them?
There are a lot of parents. At the League of Women Voters meet and greet, I met Carl Geisler. His youngest child is graduating soon, and his whole family went to Jefferson and Centennial.
It was requested, you know, be a voice for Centennial, but also be a voice for the greater community.
He works in business development. There is also one incumbent, Mark Holm, who works in finance. And then there are a lot of different occupations. There's nurse, professor, business people. Charles Jarrell Young is a therapist and social worker.
I have to collaborate. I work with youth and families, child and family team meetings. I work with law enforcement.
Justin Michael Hendricks has been an associate teacher and is a student at the University of Illinois College of Education.
Out of the 26 of us, only 2 of us are staying local after graduation. So that's a big defeat that we are now losing of potential teachers.
Emily, for this voter guide, you asked the candidates all yes or no questions about their positions on the issues. Was there anything they said that stuck out to you?
One question that seems to be really dividing the candidates this year is whether they would keep the superintendent contract going after it ends next year. So Alberto Molina says the superintendent has helped create division on the board.
One of the main reasons the board is divided is because she has convinced 3 board members then they need to be with her, 100%.
He founded a bilingual school in Nicaragua and plans to be a full-time board member if elected in Champaign. Fatima Ahmed is a biostatistician at the University of Illinois. She said she respects the superintendent, but she agrees that the stalemate will continue if the superintendent sticks around. So the community needs to rebuild trust with a fresh start.
Emily, is there anyone who is for keeping the superintendent around?
The most surprising praise I got was from Mark Holm. He was appointed this summer.
Back in May, I'm like, this superintendent's got to go. Well, I did my homework, looked in to see what's going on, got behind the scenes, and no, she's doing a really good job.
He said that if they terminate her contract early, they have to pay her extra in severance pay. So he's not for that, and he actually likes her. There's a coalition of 4 running together that want to evaluate her while in their seats and give her support first. It's led by Ronald Baker, who's an advanced practice nurse, and the husband of the current board member, Janina Baker, who is leaving the board.
A diverse group of people that was that would give the superintendent support to support some of the work and will be able to evaluate her appropriately.
And then I also want to add there are 3 people who declined to participate in my survey, Christy Arnold, Roselle Beausoleil, and Tony Bruno. And in the News Gazette, they all said that they were not in favor of keeping the superintendent.
So the candidates have differing opinions on whether to renew the superintendent's contract. Does that type of disagreement extend to any other issues?
They do agree. A lot of them agree on, for example, whether to make a statement about immigration agents coming to schools. For example, Fatima Ahmed said this.
I think when we're silent, we're sending the wrong message. I think our families need to know that schools are safe places to send their kids.
Mark Holmes said that ICE is not coming to schools, but he did explain what the board is currently planning to do. Bring in some lawyers, have any immigration agents go to the headquarters first before they go back to the schools after they've analyzed, is this a proper permit? Grace King, in the survey that I sent out, she was actually a little bit worried about the school's becoming a target if the school district puts out a strong statement, which is something that is a worry on the board right now.
Emily, what are some of the other issues at play in this race?
There are many. There's the teacher contract coming up. I was surprised by how many people are in favor of reopening the issue of redistricting, what I've been calling kind of desegregating the district more fully. That was not popular when the board brought it up a couple of years ago. Here's Grace King.
When we look at schools of choice, perhaps revising that model to ensure that all schools have the resources.
She said that if they communicate the issue earlier, then they would have more success. She's an education professor at Illinois State University.
I've been talking with Emily Hayes, education reporter at Illinois Public Media. You can find her guide to the candidates running for the Champaign Unit 4 School Board at ipmnewsroom.org.
And don't forget to vote on Tuesday, April 1st. Employees at the Veterans Affairs Medical Center in Danville have been temporarily rehired after a judge ruled against the Trump administration's efforts to fire thousands of federal workers. But as IPM's May Antar reports, one of those employees at the VA is worried she may not be back for long.
As someone who comes from a family of veterans, Chris Huffman says she has always wanted to give back to those who served. She's been doing administrative work at the VA Center in Danville for almost 2 years. When Huffman was fired in February, just months short of finishing her probationary period, she was devastated and didn't know what to do next.
If I were to get cut now, they would owe me nothing. If I get cut as a regular employee, non-probationary employee, I would at least be considered a displaced federal worker.
She lost her livelihood with no notice, and she was set to lose her health insurance while living with a heart condition. After a judge ordered federal employees be reinstated, Huffman said it was really nice to come back to her dream job.
But now, it's still laced with uncertainty.
Huffman says the VA facility in Danville expects up to a fifth of its workforce could be cut by the end of their fiscal year in September.
It's all up in the air, which is frustrating. I like to have, you know, certain control over my life and what I do, but this is kind of out of my control right now.
And she says that makes it hard to have a feeling of job security, especially when she doesn't know exactly how many workers will be fired. May Antar, IPM News.
You're listening to Dialogue from Illinois Seoul. When the COVID-19 pandemic hit 5 years ago, the stark health inequities in Chicago became much more visible. People who live in West Garfield Park, which is 92% Black, can expect to die 25 years earlier than those who live in the Loop. Kristen Schorsch of Chicago NPR station WBEZ explains how community leaders and public health officials are working to close this gap.
X marker and 2%.
Inside a warehouse on Chicago's west side, I feel like I'm in a market. There are freezers of whitefish and chicken drumsticks, boxes of fruit and plump carrots, and aisles of bread, beans, and pasta. Daisy Gabrielle makes her way through a list of names of low-income seniors. She's making sure she doesn't miss any items they picked from a menu.
And Mercedes got the catfish?
Yes.
Okay. As we're talking about honoring the request, just want to make sure.
Gabrielle fills bright green bags full of fresh food. They'll go along with boxes of dry food she plans to drop off later this morning. She runs the home delivery program at Beyond Hunger. It's a nonprofit that also has a food pantry. Clients that get food delivered are mostly homebound and live alone. They don't have much access to fresh food. The pandemic illuminated inequities like this.
I really want to make sure that we do right by them, that we're getting the food that they ask for, that if 1 month they say, like, can I please just get an extra peanut butter? Like, little ways that we can do it. We put birthday cards in the boxes. We're putting Christmas gifts during the holidays. We've had people be like, this was the only thing I had on my tree. And it's just, I know what that is.
And Gabrielle grew up with four siblings and a single mom. She relied on food assistance as a kid, in college, and during COVID, when she lost a previous job. Beyond Hunger has expanded the home delivery program into Austin, and they added an extra delivery of fresh produce each month. It helps stretch the groceries a bit more. Gabrielle wheels a cart full of food outside. Her colleagues and a volunteer pack a small bus with boxes and those bright green bags.
So we'll put them all along the seats, and then we'll put them on the floor.
In a bit, they'll head to an apartment building in Oak Park, where about 40 seniors wait for their food. It's programs like these that are trying to help shrink that staggering life expectancy gap in Chicago by helping residents get healthier. Black Chicagoans are expected to die earlier than any other race or ethnicity. The biggest gap is between Asian and Black Chicagoans, 16 years. Dr. Simbo Ige runs the Chicago Public Health Department. She's not surprised these gaps haven't shrunk.
There is a zero-sum mindset, like if we try and put additional resources and some support in communities that are more impacted, everybody else feels like it is taking something away from them.
Even after a pandemic, Ige says there are still people who live in neighborhoods without enough access to food and medicine. But she says there are some improvements. Fewer people are dying from opioid overdoses, for example. One of her biggest challenges will be money. Her budget is drastically reduced this year. And more cuts could be on the way from the federal government. Gabrielle arrives at the senior building in Oak Park and heads to Margaret Burbridge's apartment.
Grocery delivery.
Hi, how are you?
Good, it smells so good in here.
Even though she picked the items off a menu, Burbridge is excited to see what she got.
I look forward to it. I'm waiting for them like their family coming to bring me a present, okay?
In her kitchen, she opens up a box and pulls out fresh collards.
It's always healthy and look like it just came from the store or the garden.
Then she takes out bananas and carrots and talks about how she likes to season the chicken. Burbridge is on a fixed income. She says it's helpful not to have to make an extra trip to the store to buy items like milk, butter, and eggs, especially since eggs have become so much more expensive.
It definitely stretches my food further.
And she shares the food with other residents in her building. Beyond Hunger surveyed their clients in the home delivery program last year. They appear to be helping seniors get healthier. Over half said they ate more fruits and vegetables, managed diabetes and blood pressure better, and they felt more connected to their community. Kristen Schorsch, WBEC News.
A trip to a museum ended up charting a new course for a woman who was inspired by something she saw there. She talked about her journey during a presentation at Western Illinois University in Macomb. She also talked about her experiences with Rich Egger.
Tara Roberts moved to Washington, D.C. around 8 years ago to work for a nonprofit. It was a good job, but she wanted to do more around the issue of race. And then someone gave her a ticket to the National Museum of African American History and Culture. She went, even though she's not much of one for visiting museums.
And I saw a picture there that completely altered my world. It was a picture of a group of primarily Black women in wetsuits on a boat. I had never seen a group of Black women in wetsuits on a boat before.
Roberts says the picture struck a chord. She saw women who looked like her and were leading an adventurous life.
And I didn't know that that was possible before. And it really touched me.
Roberts ended up leaving her job so she could follow the women who were part of the group Diving with a Purpose. They go around the world to document slave shipwrecks. First, though, she had to take a 3-month scuba diving training course. Roberts grew up in Atlanta and had never gone scuba diving. In addition, she had no funding, but she listened to her inner voice and trusted her instincts to follow the women.
I took this leap, and it got me here. So I feel really thankful and grateful.
You just dove in, huh? I know. Bad pun.
You can't help it.
But how good of a scuba diver are you now?
Oh, I am not great. My lane, I'm a storyteller. These divers have like thousands of dives under their belts. They can do crazy things underwater. I can kind of hang. Like, I don't completely embarrass myself, but I got a long way to go to match them.
As a storyteller and journalist, Robert started documenting the journey, and she secured a grant from National Geographic to help fund her work. It resulted in the 6-part podcast, into the depths.
I descended. The water was this murky blue and green. It felt warm against my skin. Schools of fish were swimming by. Then I saw it. The outline of an anchor.
Roberts also wrote about the experience in the newly released book, Written in the Waters. And Roberts is now a National Geographic Explorer in Residence. She says they'll be doing a part two of this project. She cannot go into much detail yet, but says it will honor the past and memorialize the loss of life from the slave trade. She says around 12,000 ships brought Africans to the Americas.
12,000 ships. But I realized when I was growing up that I couldn't tell you the name of a single one of those ships. But I could tell you the name of the Mayflower. I could tell you all about the Titanic. Like, there's an enormous amount of history that's just unexplored and unexamined.
She says they're going to the bottom of the ocean and helping bring this history back into collective human memory. And she says they're not just stories of tragedy, trauma, and death.
There are also stories of resilience and resistance and survival. And there are even stories of laughter and love and joy. It's so much that's a part of this history. So I feel like there is so much work still to be done and so many more stories still to be told about it.
Growing up, Roberts was interested in science fiction, some of which takes readers to the depths of outer space. She never imagined her life would take her to the depths of the Earth's oceans, a journey that landed her on the cover and in the pages of National Geographic magazine. Rich Egger reporting.
Connoisseurs of cookbooks know a fact about them. The recipes are only half the fun. The recipes may not even be that original. What makes a cookbook distinct, if anything, is the author story, which is definitely true of a cookbook that is being republished after a century and a half. Here's NPR's Netta Ulaby.
Melinda Russell wrote this cookbook in 1866. We know sadly little about her, says Professor Rafia Zafar.
She's widowed early. She has a handicapped child. She starts her own business. She has a pastry shop.
That shop may explain why you can find at least 100 recipes for sweets in her book, called A Domestic Cookbook. The sweets are old-fashioned. Allspice cake, French lady cake, lemon puffs, boiled berry pudding. They still sound delicious. Melinda Russell was never enslaved. She became the first Black woman in America that we know of to write her own cookbook soon after the end of the Civil War.
She lived in North Carolina. She lived in Tennessee. But she had to leave the South because of what she said, her Union principles.
She ended up in Paw Paw, Michigan.
So today I'm making Melinda Russell's drop ginger cake.
On YouTube, people like Matthew Gillen pay tribute to Melinda Russell by making her recipes. This video is part of an online cooking series from the Virginia Museum of History and Culture.
That goes all together in a pot.
It's not easy to adapt 160-year-old recipes to the age of the Instapot, says Rafia Zafar. Here's an example from Russell's cookbook.
This is the recipe. 1 pound flour, 1 ditto butter, 9 eggs, 2 quarts milk, a little yeast, mixed together warm. That's the recipe.
Zafar finds it fun to read old recipes, she says, because they take you on a journey.
People always say reading cookbooks are like reading novels, but reading cookbooks are also like reading ethnographies and travel books.
Time travel books. And in this Black History Month in 2025, what a joy, she says, to meet a determined, resourceful heroine in Melinda Russell, who reminds readers today how creativity and talent have circulated and survived. Netta Ulaby, NPR News.
And we thank you for listening to this week's Dialogue. Our team includes Kennedy Vincent, Ariel Raveny, and Patricia Bradford. The theme was composed by Lamont Holden. Dialogue and Illinois Soul are part of Illinois Public Media, which is a service of the University of Illinois Urbana-Champaign. I'm Reginald Hardwick. We'll have a dialogue with you again next week.